You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're going to unpack the latest volley in budget negotiations in Albany with the Democratic majorities in the Assembly and Senate formally outlining their fiscal and policy priorities for the final budget negotiations. To help us make sense of these proposals, we're joined once again by Patrick Arecki, Director of State Studies for the Citizens Budget Commission, a business-backed fiscal watchdog. Nice to see you remotely, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the big picture. How much do these budget proposals actually plan on spending in the coming fiscal year? The governor called for $227 billion of state spending, and both houses of the legislature appear to want to spend more. But how much more are we talking?
Yeah, well, first of all, that's a great question that I'd love to be able to answer in a tremendous amount of depth. But unfortunately, one house budget proposals aren't accompanied by kind of the basic tables that show their size and out year implications for the most part. It's a recommendation that we've asked the houses and the enacted budget agreement to follow. So we can't give a totally detailed answer there, but we do have some numbers. The Assembly puts out a summary that says that their budget is on an all funds basis about $6 billion higher than what the executive put forward. So right around $233 billion for next year. That includes some federal money. On just the state side, the Assembly comes in about $4.7 billion higher than the governor.
Is it safe to assume the Senate's proposal is also billions of dollars higher than what the governor was proposing because there are all of these proposed additional spending items, whether it's hundreds of millions of dollars more on cost of living adjustments for healthcare workers or hundreds of millions of dollars more for tax credits for low-income families or for expanding access to childcare? So is it safe to assume we're talking billions of dollars more on the Senate side too?
It's safe to assume, given how similar the plans are, that the total dollar figures are very similar as well.
And are you, as the Director of State Studies for the Citizens Budget Commission, excited about plans from the Assembly and Senate to spend billions of additional dollars?
Excited, sure. We were surprised by some of the elements, both what was included and not included. What we're focused on isn't just what next year's implications are, but what the out years look like too. The budget is a multi-year document. It sets the path for the future as well. And the executive budget, we were concerned, had big out-year budget gaps already and relied on a lot of non-recurring revenue sources from federal aid, from temporary taxes, from rolling balances forward, things like that. And by adding billions of dollars in spending, we basically see the same issues not only persist, but essentially are exacerbated in the out years, which is very, very fiscally risky.
Are you agnostic then about what they're looking to spend money on? For example, is there a case to be made that investments made now are worthwhile and the out year issues be damned, so to speak?
There isn't the work done in New York State, as some other states do, to kind of measure and manage for performance and build your budgets around what needs are and aligning the available resources with needs. We do a great job of measuring progress just based on dollars spent, but not a great job measuring progress based on performance and outcomes of the services and programs that the state delivers.
Well, turning to the other side of the equation here, which is how do you actually pay for billions of additional dollars in spending? I know the Assembly and Senate are both looking at increasing tax rates on New Yorkers making more than $5 million a year. Will that cover everything we're talking about here, or will they need to find additional revenue sources, or could they touch into the sacred cow for watchdogs like yourself, the budget reserves?
They do appear to be doing both plus a little bit more. There are two in the one house budget's closely aligned tax increase proposals. Both, as you said, raise personal income taxes on individuals earning above $5 million a year and also have some business tax increase. They took slightly different tax, but very similar in that each of those proposals raise about $1 billion, most of which is then dedicated to closing the MTA's budget gaps. We also see, at least in the Assembly's plan for the planned deposits to reserves, they do take about $1.4 billion out of the so-called principal reserves, kind of the rainy day savings, to fund some of the spending next year.
That seems like a very responsible way to approach this problem then. You don't want to just spend money without identifying the source. You must be happy with that sort of prudent planning.
The biggest concern is using a one-time resource again to pay for recurring costs. If you take $1.4 billion out of the reserve plan to pay for new costs next year, you essentially are recognizing that you're going to have to do something similar in every future year. And we're not in a situation where we should be taking any money out of the rainy day funds and the principal reserves in any circumstance, but especially when it's to pay for new recurring spending that can't support in the out years.
Well, for listeners just joining us, you're listening to Patrick Arecki, and he is the Director of State Studies for the Citizens Budget Commission, a business-backed fiscal watchdog. So I want to turn to a major part of the budget that was unveiled by Governor Kathy Hochul in February, which is this idea of a housing compact, where she is hoping to increase the housing supply over the next 10 years by 800,000 new homes, which would be doubling the rate of home creation compared to the previous 10 years. The Senate and Assembly are not inclined to embrace some of the sticks that the governor's plan would utilize to essentially cajole municipalities into allowing for more housing creation. What do you think that does to the actual merits of the Governor's housing compact? Does that effectively neuter it and make it impossible to achieve the housing creation she envisions?
In a word, yes. I think just to level set, housing production of all kinds is an urgent and long time need of the state. Especially downstate, housing production has not kept up with jobs, not even close, hasn't done so for many years. So this is a problem that's been building over time. It's not new, it's not a surprise. What the governor put forward was a plan that had many components to it, one of which was the housing compact that said local governments should essentially enact a couple types of housing production options or hit overall housing production goals, and they'll be all set. If they don't, it had, as you know, the analogy is carrots and sticks, it had some of the sticks to then kind of allow builders to build if the local government wasn't hitting that housing compact goal. So, what we saw in the One House budget proposals was essentially from both houses taking out every one of the elements of what the governor had put forward, which is quite disappointing. The Senate did add a plan that essentially would create a land use advisory council, which would be empowered with about $500 million initially to try to just offer the metaphorical carrots to say, if you do produce housing, we'll give you money. I think the issue with that approach, with just saying all we need is some more carrots, is that there are already plenty of carrots right now. There's already plenty of positive incentives to building new housing. Local governments still choose not to do it all over the state. The other kind of issue with that is that also the carrots will, just as a matter of fact, probably be going to the places that have most successfully been exclusionary in their zoning for a long time. They'll be the most readily able to get paid for building a little bit of new housing under that type of arrangement.
Another major issue for both the governor as well as a lot of downstate lawmakers is this idea of meeting the needs of the New York City transit system, which is perennially underfunded and is always in need of major capital investments. What, if anything, are the Senate and Assembly looking to do to shore up the system's finances and potentially improve the services it offers to riders in the New York City area?
Both the governor and the houses put forward plans to offer some subsidy to balance the MTA budget. There's essentially a couple billion dollar operating gap in what the MTA needs, mostly because ridership has dropped off, essentially induced by the pandemic. So fare box revenue is down. The One House proposals dedicate the vast majority of those two tax increases on personal income and on businesses to help cover that gap for the MTA. And to be clear, that is an absolutely urgent issue, a reliable and fiscally sustainable MTA is absolutely critical to the economic success of New York City, of the downstate region, of the state, of the whole Northeast region. You know, CBC's position is that any plan to help close the MTA budget gap should also include efficiency savings and productivity savings from the system itself, not just offering another tranche of subsidy to the system to help cover these gaps in perpetuity. I think the reality is, in a few years' time, if we don't take a hard lens at improving productivity and efficiency of the system, we're going to be having this discussion again in a couple of years' time and looking for another subsidy.
Is there reason to believe that there are meaningful dollar amounts worth of inefficiencies that can be targeted within the MTA system? Or is that just a red herring that we can return to year after year if we don't want to actually increase investments?
You know, at least CBC's recommendation is that the plan should essentially be 50-50, at least productivity versus new revenue sources. We're talking about a $2 billion plan altogether at most to cover the gaps. CBC had previously identified about $2.9 billion in recurring savings options a couple of years ago that we put on the table for exactly this type of issue emerging over time. So I think there's plenty of opportunity. It's about working with everybody involved at the table, labor, the system itself, to make sure that you are finding the most readily achievable savings that help close these gaps.
And when it comes to the state's actual investment in the MTA, are you agnostic, though, about where that money comes from? Obviously, the governor was looking to tax certain businesses that operate in the MTA region, but there's obviously other ideas being floated around, like taxes on package deliveries and other ideas. What are your thoughts on where the money comes from?
I think one of the concerns that we had was how the governor, at least, had put a lot of the burden onto New York City. I think that's one thing that we've said the state should be a little more proactive in its own subsidy before requiring the city to take a hole out of its own budget. Certainly, tax increases are something that we want to avoid and in fact move in the opposite direction on globally. We have the highest personal income tax rates already in the nation. We have the highest corporate tax rates when you are in New York City in the MTA region by far in the nation. So building more recurring taxes on top of those presents a competitiveness risk too. And that's why, to the degree you can use productivity to close this gap, it's an even better option.
What about funding some of the needs of the MTA with a fare increase?
Yeah, I think the plans for the regular small fare increases are something that we support. The system relies a lot on fare box revenue, and it should. It's a reliable source of revenue for the system. So the modest incremental fare increases that have been planned for a long time are something that we support as part of the plan.
Well, we've been speaking with Patrick Arecki. He is the Director of State Studies for the Citizens Budget Commission, a business-backed fiscal watchdog. Patrick, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capitol Press Room provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. Visit unionstrongny.org for more information. Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.